Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
SpinQuest Social Casino. The presents are open and you're over the in-laws. It's a perfect time to grab your phone and play SpinQuest.com with live dealer blackjack, craps, and a ton of slots. And here's a great deal for the holiday, a $30 coin pack for $10. And if you're hearing this ad, you can play right now on SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Hello and welcome to Contemplations. I am joined by Connor.
Hello.
Who's not 100%. You're not very well today.
I'm doing my best. I'll power through. I'll try not to cough directly into the microphone and destroy the ears of all of our viewers.
And what we're going to be talking about today is how to spot a liar. And to save the commenters the trouble, yes, if someone describes himself as a journalist or a politician, you don't need to deduce anything. We already know by default. But with the rest of that out of the way, what we're going to be talking about today are things like the polygraph test and other psychological tests that can find out whether someone is lying, perhaps used to the detriment of freedom, of course, because imagine a sort of 1984 scenario where the government has you in a room threatening you, and then they hook you up to a machine that can tell that you're lying.
This is like the pre-crime division of Minority Report or Captain America the Winter Soldier, where if they can interrogate your proclivity to be dishonest, then they can just assume you're going to commit crimes in the future and you're too much of a threat. So they can use that as pretext to clamp down on your civil liberties.
So other than it just being interesting, there are actually political implications, and there is good reason to believe that these sorts of techniques are going to be used by governments, if not being used already. But some of them, certainly the more recent ones, not the polygraph test, the ones that seem to be a bit more reliable, are still being developed. The research isn't quite finished yet. But also we are going to talk about just visual ways of spotting whether someone is lying, although obviously those aren't 100%. And then we're going to talk a little bit about criminal profiling, which is sort of a related topic, but a bit of an aside. But we have some interesting things to say about it. We thought it's, because it's loosely related, we would mention it as well as a bit of a bonus, really. So you know a bit about the old polygraph or lie detector test.
Well, the precursor to the polygraph test was the systolic blood pressure test. And the reason I knew a bit about it is because it was invented by William Moulton Marston, who was also the creator of Wonder Woman. That's why she has the lasso of truth. He was not only obsessed with bondage and feminism, but also interrogation and being able to find the truth by some kind of apparatus, and so he made it her superpower. And so there's some really interesting history about him.
It's a bit strange that someone who's obsessed about finding truth was a feminist, but there we go.
Yeah, he had some really odd opinions, which I think might provide just some interesting tidbits of historical background. So the systolic blood pressure test became one component of the modern polygraph test, which was eventually invented by John Augustus Larson in Berkeley, California. And the test involved blood pressure cuffs and a stethoscope to take intermittent blood pressure during questioning. And it said it knew if your heart rate or blood pressure fluctuated, that would be most likely indicated that you were lying. Marston also invented an early polygraph machine, and although his device was ruled inadmissible for core evidence in Fry v. United States, he found new spins for the lie detector in almost every new business venture. At one point, he used it in a Gillette ad. In time, his invention morphed into a sister device called a love detector. Marston theatrically strapped his detector to attractive female students at press demonstrations, claiming to read which classmate they liked best. Marston's detectors formed the basis for Wonder Woman's Golden Lasso of Truth, but it was his extracurricular activities that proved much more formative for creating Wonder Woman specifically. From an early age, he was fascinated with the power of women. As Jill Lepore recounts in The Secret History of Wonder Woman, he saw the militant British suffragist Emily Pankhurst speak at Harvard in 1911, and was enthralled. His inner circle would soon include a collection of suffragists, birth control activists, and revolutionaries. Perhaps most prominent link to this was world was Olive Byrne, his mistress and also the niece of Margaret Sanger. So even though you say that it's strange that a feminist would be obsessed with finding the truth, it's not shocking that he would be obsessed with creating an apparatus which would provide totalitarian certainty to a government to determine either unconscious bias or the proclivity to commit crimes or be actively lying. So he did have an interest in perfecting the world, bringing it to its progressive historicist apotheosis for men and women. And so it's not surprising that he was investing in psychological measures to try and bring that about.
Mm. At least he didn't invest his time into a misogyny detector. That would have been, imagine the world if that was the thing he invented rather than the polygraph.
Well, by modern standards, he probably would have fallen afoul of it himself, considering
that's true.
Olive Byrne, his mistress, who he aesthetically based Wonder Woman off of, was a student of his that he then brought into his marriage, and they all lived together, and then he kept having bondage parties with a bunch of his students.
Seems healthy.
Yeah, definitely doesn't seem like there's any corruption going on for grades there at all. He also created something called DISC theory, so that's an acronym describing personality through four central traits, which is dominance, inducement, submission, and compliance.
I wonder where he got those ideas from.
Yeah, you know the Nietzschean thing of all philosophy is confession? Well, turns out this is all just sexual projection. Mm-hmm. A lot of the early Wonder Woman comics as well were obsessed with her being tied up and incapacitated. That's why she has those braces.
Oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah, the original creation of Themyscira was because Hercules had apprehended, and Ares, I believe, as well, apprehended the Amazons as daughters of Aphrodite. And so it was the patriarchal, oppressive, warmongering man subduing the loving women. And so they broke their bondage. And so they wore things like ropes and cuffs in order to symbolize how women were breaking free and taking ownership of their submission. And yeah, it's just painful. Not good. So the DISC theory described personality through four traits. Dominance, the active use of force to overcome resistance. Inducement, the use of charm in order to deal with obstacles, so more persuasion rather than physical violence. Submission, which is the warm and voluntary acceptance of the need to fulfill a request. And compliance, the fearful adjustment to a superior force. So it's all about voluntary complementarianism or being overbearing versus being so anxious that you just comply. And so Marston's analysis said that dominance is characterized by actively using force to overcome resistance. Inducement involves using persuasion. Submission is voluntary, and compliance is fear. And that is nowadays only really applied to like random business seminars where they're talking about boosting confidence, but it's not a very valid psychological metric by
no it's not a scientific theory. It's basically just people, whenever something is just categorizing human experience into certain categories, it is just reductionistic in its method. It's trying to generalize everything to a point where it's so simple that it can be grouped, but the reality of the human condition is that grouping things into discrete categories is often very difficult, as well as the fact that there's so many individual differences between people that it's very difficult to come up with universals that actually hold up to scrutiny.
Mm. It seems like a psychoanalytic categorization method that allows you to test, especially with the blood pressure thing, how willing you are to be aggressive under certain questions. Therefore, we can put you in this box and deem you a likely oppressor, or that you are likely fitting the profile for a particular crime that we're interrogating you for. And mm-hmm. if you're a dominant personality type, then you'll be put under more scrutiny. And so that just seems, it doesn't seem very valid, and it also seems it will run afoul of
it seems like there's some sort of agenda there. As with many, I mean, it's very difficult to create a theory without baking in your own beliefs into it. So, you know, although I think he's not a good guy, you got to cut him a little bit of slack for having some sort of agenda to what he does, because everyone does, obviously.
Yeah, he openly admitted he wanted a matriarchal government, and so he wanted to make submission the paramount virtue that men would adopt. He said,
a male feminist into submission to women? No way.
Well, he said, it seemed to me from a psychological angle that the comics' worst defense was their blood-curdling masculinity. A male hero, at best, lacks the qualities of maternal love and tenderness, which are as essential to a normal child as the breath of life. Suppose your child's ideal becomes a Superman who uses his extraordinary power to help the weak. The most important ingredient in the human happiness recipe is still missing. Love. It's smart to be strong, it's big to be generous, but it's sissified according to exclusively masculine rules to be tender, loving, affectionate, and alluring. Oh, that's girls' stuff, snorts young comic readers. Who wants to be a girl? And that's the point. Not even girls want to be girls, so long as our feminine archetype lacks force, strength, and power. Not wanting to be girls, I don't want to be tender, submissive, peace-loving, as good women are. Women's strong qualities have become despised because of their weak ones. The obvious remedy is to create beautiful feminine characters with all the strength of Superman, plus the allure of a good and beautiful woman. That's what I recommend to publishers. So, I suppose... I wonder if he had a particular political angle here in trying to administer these tests to the criminal justice system to try and identify dominant personalities through physiological metrics and then persecute them as such. I wonder if that would be a pathway to matriarchy.
I don't mean to turn all Freudian, but I wonder what his relationship with his mother was like. I mean, when you hear about this, just like, yes, I want to be subservient to a matriarchy. I mean... It's the same thing when I hear women just like, yes, I want to be forced in the kitchen and I don't want any voting rights. I'm just like, well...
What's her number?
Yeah, I know that's something you admire, but I find it a bit strange. I think that there's got to be some sort of deficit going on there.
Yeah,
if you don't want your own autonomy.
Yeah, it's nice to have a little bit of intellectual pushback over the dinner table, but when you're home...
So, are you done introducing?
Yes, go
okay.
for it.
So, I was going to talk a little bit about how the actual polygraph test works and what it measures. And through knowing what it measures and how it works, you can better understand not only, you know, the procedure of how it's carried out, but also how to cheat it. And that's certainly what I'm going to be talking about, because, of course, it's one of those things where when I went to university and they're just like, yeah, we can teach you to cheat a lie detector test. Like the devil on my shoulder was just like, ah, oh, think of the things you can do, Josh. But with my evil schemes aside, so the polygraph test assesses three indicators of what is known as autonomic arousal, which is basically just stimulation of your nervous system in English. So... it's either your heart rate or blood pressure. That's one metric, or you can measure both of them. Respiration and skin conductivity. So this is often called your galvanic skin response. That's what I know it as. And I have actually taken tests. I've been a participant in experiments where they've taken my skin response a few times, actually. Normally, my hands get too sweaty for it to carry on, so I can only do a few trials before they're just like, yes, it's useless. Which is worth bearing in mind, because very few people who talk about the polygraph test actually talk about the actual practical limitations of it. They talk about the theoretical ones, but sometimes, like, if you had a really, really fat guy, you're not going to have equipment to measure his heart rate or blood pressure and respiration, because it's designed to be quite tight on a normal person. Perhaps they just won't fit. So if you want to lie, get really fat. Or if you want to lie and get away with it.
That's the Boris Johnson strategy, isn't it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But I feel like being sweaty is probably the best way to get out of the skin conductivity thing. So I'm pretty sure you can take things that make you perspire, can't you? I can't remember what they're called.
You should tell Prince Andrew.
Yeah. Apparently a trip to Epstein's Island cures.
No, he was in a Pizza Express, bro. Definitely. Totally believe it.
So the rate and depth of respiration, these are measured by pneumographs, which are wrapped around the subject's chest, as you can see in this picture here, kind of like a coil that just measures how much you're extending, or that's not the right word, is it? The amount you're exhaling and inhaling. is the easier way of putting it. And of course, cardiovascular activity is assessed by the blood pressure cuffs. This is normally the easiest way of doing it. I think that's normally the way in which people check things like blood pressure. I mean, when you check pulse, the place you normally go to is either the neck or the wrist. Yep. But when you're trying to do it in an environment like this, normally the wrist is just the most practical. And skin conductivity, which is measured through electrodes attached to the subject's fingertips, which is why getting sweaty is difficult, because attaching something to your fingertip, normally you put an electrode which is just taped with masking tape. That's at least what happened when I did it, and it isn't great. And sometimes just moving a little bit makes the detector flatline. So although, of course, the people will be able to see it, the people conducting the test, because they'll see, okay, it wasn't recording anything.
Yeah, but it's not the most reliable of apparatus.
No. And this is something that gets missed, and you can only really know it if you've had hands-on experience with it. So the procedure itself, there are seven distinct steps. First of all, the examiner has to explain the process of the polygraph test to the subject and obtain consent to it, at least amongst psychologists, of course. If it's law enforcement, perhaps consent isn't necessary because they're detained. But in the realm of psychology, the ethics of practice dictate that you should follow this procedure, although, of course, the other one might be a bit different. But I'm a psychologist, not a law enforcer, and I'm pretty sure lots of law enforcement avoid using these anyway. But nevertheless, the second step is that the examiner determines a question to be asked and formulates them in a neutral way. Of course, if you ask loaded questions, then you're going to get answers that aren't necessarily as truthful as you would like. I'm sure we'll talk a lot in the criminal profiling section later on about how asking loaded questions can make people confess to things that they might not otherwise confess to.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to mention it, actually, because there's something called the Reed technique. So it's actually really effective because it causes very impressionable low IQ and child to adolescents to buy into the framing of leading questions or just outright lies by prosecutors or investigators. And so it solicits a really high false confession rate. So it has an error margin of 40 to 55%.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. And then a study of 340 exonerated cases found that 42% of juvenile crimes were from false confessions. And that's a rate of 2 to 3 times higher than adults. So the adults were at 13%. It has 9 steps of interrogation. So positive confrontation, which advises the suspect that the evidence has led the police to suspect the individual, and that offers the person an early opportunity to explain why the offence took place. So baked into that is, we know you did it, here's your first chance to confess. Then the second one is, try and shift the blame away from the suspect to some other person or the circumstances that that prompted the suspect to commit the crime. So that's saying, well, maybe it was this person, maybe it was the situation you found yourself in, and so this is your get-out clause. This might allow someone to shift the blame if they did do it, or it might make someone suggestible and afraid to try and blame someone else and implicate them in the crime. So you get a sort of Salem witch trials thing going on. Then try and minimize the frequency of the suspect's denials. So try and I hesitate to say gaslight them, but do not affirm their ability to say that I didn't do it. You continue pressing them, saying we know you did, even if they didn't. At this point, then it says the accused will often give a reason why he or she did not or could not have committed the crime. Try and use this to move towards the acknowledgement of what they did. So even if they're telling you that they didn't, you have to take that as that they did. And then reinforce the sincerity to ensure that the suspect is receptive. So say, it's okay, we're going to help you through this. We're going to make sure that you get the most lenient sentence possible if you just tell us what you did. Then the suspect will become quieter and listen. Move the theme of the discussion toward offering alternatives. If the suspect cries at this point, infer guilt, especially with children or people who are cognitively impaired. If they're crying under stress, you take this as a sign of guilt. So this is This is a technique that they're all taught to do. Pose the alternative question by giving two choices for what happened, one more socially acceptable than the other. The suspect is expected to choose the easier option, but whichever alternative the suspect chooses, guilt is admitted. There is always a third option, which is to maintain they did not commit the crime. Then number 8, lead the suspect to repeat the admission of guilt in front of witnesses and develop corroborating information to establish the validity of the confession. And then number 9, document the suspect's admission of confession or have him or her prepare a recorded statement, audio, video, or written. And so 81% of the false confessions from this result in convictions. So even though they know this is likely to lead to false confessions from children and cognitively impaired people, even though most of those that have been overturned on the basis of false confessions were that, 81% of the false confessions still lead to convictions. And this is the way in which the American three-letter agencies are taught to interrogate suspects.
I knew it was bad from a methodological point of view in that it's almost designed to get false confessions. Mm. And I think that's effectively what it does. Yep. It's a very effective tool of getting confessions, whether they're truthful or not. Is very different.
Yeah. If nobody's seen Making a Murderer, that is a really good example. So Brendan Dassey's 2016, his original confession was released in a document in 2016 by his post-conviction trial team. And that now reveals that law enforcement professionals themselves are using his confession tape as an example of how not to apply the Reid technique. But Brendan Dassey is still in prison. It's genuinely quite mad. So they're still using the technique, which has led to so many false confessions. And the example they use of how to achieve a false confession using the technique, the guy is still in prison, even though he's saying, I didn't do it. It's clearly broken. To
play devil's advocate here, it is really difficult not to be biased. And especially if you've invested a lot of time and energy and there's a lot of social pressure upon you to find someone guilty, then... There is a tendency towards that sort of perhaps irresponsible questioning.
I don't want to write off all these techniques either, because I don't know if you've heard of the Chris Watts murders.
There was
a Netflix documentary on American Murder, Family Next Door. And the reason that he ended up confessing to, not that his wife and kids had gone missing or run away, but that he'd actually killed his wife and kids and buried his kids in a giant oil tanker where he worked, was because he scored poorly on the polygraph. And so that prompted him to think the game was up. So it can correctly infer sometimes that people are lying and pressure them into being more forthcoming with their confessions. It's just not watertight. Neither is the Reid technique.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there are lots of different techniques to make people confess. Like you could, in theory, put a toy stuffed monkey on the desk and just get inside someone's head, just like the monkey can tell you're lying. Because it's so strange, they're like, what? Well, it throws people off, it puts them off guard, and it kind of throws a cat amongst the pigeons in what they expect from the interview. And you can use anything as a sort of crutch to get people to confess if you can get inside their head and make them think it's all over when actually it's not.
But I think a technique like that would also only properly work on, again, children and people who are quite impaired. And that's why you have to be quite careful as to who is present during the interrogation. I think they're trying still to pass a law in America that means that you cannot interrogate a minor or someone with a certain IQ level without either a lawyer or a guardian present, because that has been done plenty of times, like it was in the Dassey case.
I'm just going to go and get a really low IQ score in a test. I'm going to deliberately sabotage myself. So... I know it's in the US, but still. Where was I? I think I read out number 2, didn't I?
Yes.
So step 3, after they've formulated the questions in a neutral way, which is easier said than done, the examiner conducts a pre-test interview to gather background information and establish a bit of rapport with the subject themselves and clarify the questions. I think a very important thing in telling whether someone's lying is understanding their mannerisms, how they actually talk normally. So talking to them in a way that's sort of friendly, where they're not incentivized to lie about things. So just like, how are you? Asking a few questions, like, oh, where are you from? getting them to talk a bit about themselves, it'll put them a bit at ease because that's a topic which they're familiar with. Mm. And therefore, you can get a very clear picture of how someone acts when they're not under pressure.
Yeah, there's also two benefits to that. Either if they're guilty, it allows you to disarm them somewhat and make it easier to discern whether or not they're lying. Or it might help them set them at ease if they're very apprehensive about taking the test because they're worried about getting a false positive because they genuinely are innocent. It might relax them a bit and not prejudice the physiological markers that might say that they would be lying.
Well, if they are relaxed as well, the spikes on the polygraph test will become more obvious. If they're running at a higher rate of anxiety, the extent that you can see the line from the deviation, it's sometimes quite difficult to infer whether something is a spike or whether it's just an anomalous result. Mm. For example, I've taken the galvanic skin response thing, and sometimes just having like an itch on my foot would make it spike.
Do you want to tell the story you told me off air or not?
No.
No, I didn't think you did.
Basically, the skin response thing gave away...
That you found the examiner quite attractive.
Yes.
Yes, there we go.
But yeah, it works to some extent. But then also, I was just like, oh, she's going to be looking at that in a minute, so I better control myself. And then all of a sudden, it was back to normal again. Yep. So it's not exactly that obvious sometimes, particularly if you're not looking at it at the time when it was being set up. Mm. But number four, the subject is connected to the polygraph instruments and baseline readings of physiological responses such as, you know, blood pressure, heart rate, respiration are taken. And you need the baseline, obviously, to compare when they're asked questions. And you try and get an average. Quite often, this can be done in computer software now where it calculates it for you rather than you having to eyeball it. And you can have it depending on the software that you use, this is true of a lot of neuroscientific software. If there's a significant peak from the average, what the software can do is test whether that difference is significant at a statistical level, which basically negates the probability that it's a product of chance compared to the baseline that you've established already. So it actually can be quite objective as long as the setup is correct and you approach it in the correct way. So number five is that the examiner asks a series of questions, believe it or not, which includes relevant questions to whatever they're trying to find out, as well as comparison questions, which are asked among the relevant questions just to establish a baseline response, because as questioning might go on, maybe they become more and more anxious. So that baseline might give you lots of false positives. So you don't want that. You want to consistently ask questions relative to the baseline closest to the question you're asking in the sequence of questions, if that makes sense. And of course, you want some control questions as well, where you're just asking questions for the sake of it, just so it muddies the water in what you're actually asking about. Because, of course, most people are not stupid. Actually, that's a bit of a... I take that back. Mm-hmm. In this instance, people are smart enough to realise that, hey, maybe these questions that they're asking me about that person that they found dead, maybe that relates to them accusing me of murder.
This is one of the main problems, actually, with conducting psychological studies in universities, is because the majority of university study participants are psychology students, because you're trying to get credit, because one of your modules is how many lab hours do you do?
Yes.
And so what ends up happening is lots of the well-versed psychology undergrads start cracking the method as they're taking the test of the postgrads.
Not only that, I've gone so far to say to an experimenter, oh, you're investigating this topic, aren't you?
Yeah, and they just have to throw your results out.
Well, they don't necessarily, depending on the test.
Most of them should.
Some of them, for example, if it's things like visual perception, even if you know what you're doing, it doesn't really affect your result. Mm. And a lot of the research that goes on at universities is cognitive research. So it's more sensory data that isn't so metacognitive. It isn't so wrapped up in your consciousness. Therefore, knowing about it, being aware of it, isn't so important because the processes aren't conscious in the first place. But I've said to them before, oh, is your research paper titled something like this? And they were just like, oh, that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
It's close, but I didn't get it spot on, but I was being a smart ass. So.
That's why it's quite difficult to do those sorts of studies, the non-sensory data ones that aren't subjected to the general public, because they will just crack the research method and might prejudice the results. So,
to watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.
QTS is building more than a data center in Dane County. We're partnering with Alliant Energy to enable 750 megawatts of new renewable energy sources, supporting sustainable generation while lowering costs. We use a closed-loop, water-free cooling system that conserves billions of gallons of water each year. And we're investing millions locally, from scholarships and workforce development to nonprofits and first responders. QTS, powered by people, driven by purpose. Paid for by QTS.
Did you know that over 80% of companies in America, each generating more than $100 million in revenue, don't show up on public stock exchanges? They're private and are largely not an option for 401k investors. But now there's a chance for everyday American savers to opt in for access through the 401k plan if they choose to. Regardless of how you're building for the future, you deserve the same opportunities because you've earned the right to more. Learn more by visiting retiresafer.org. Paid for by the Council for a Safe and Secure Retirement.
QTS is building more than a data center in Dane County. We're partnering with Alliant Energy to enable 750 megawatts of new renewable energy sources, supporting sustainable generation while lowering costs. We use a closed-loop, water-free cooling system that conserves billions of gallons of water each year. And we're investing millions locally, from scholarships and workforce development to nonprofits and first responders. QTS, powered by people, driven by purpose. Paid for by QTS.